may be groups that are not reviled as evil or subhuman, but are feared as potential predators and eliminated in preemptive attacks, such as in the Balkan anarchy following the breakup of Yugoslavia. So far, I have tried to explain genocide in the following way. The mind's habit of essentialism can lump people into categories. Its moral emotions can be applied to them in their entirety. The combination can transform Hobbesian competition among individuals or armies into Hobbesian competition among peoples. But genocide has another fateful component. As Solzhenitsyn pointed out, to kill by the millions, you need an ideology. Utopian creeds that submerge individuals into moralized categories may take root in powerful regimes and engage their full destructive might. For this reason, it is ideologies that generate the outliers in the distribution of genocide death tolls. Divisive ideologies include Christianity during the Crusades and the Wars of Religion, and in an offshoot, the Taiping Rebellion in China, revolutionary romanticism during the politicides of the French Revolution, nationalism during the genocides in Ottoman Turkey and the Balkans, Nazism in the Holocaust, and Marxism during the purges, expulsions, and terror famines in Stalin's Soviet Union, Mao's China, and Pol Pot's Cambodia. Why should utopian ideologies so often lead to genocide? At first glance, it seems to make no sense. Even if an actual utopia is unattainable for all kinds of practical reasons, shouldn't the quest for a perfect world at least leave us with a better one? A world that is 60% of the way to perfection, say, or even 15%? After all, a man's reach must exceed his grasp. Shouldn't we aim high, dream the impossible dream, imagine things that never were, and ask, why not? Utopian ideologies invite genocide for two reasons. One is that they set up a pernicious utilitarian calculus. In a utopia, everyone is happy forever, so its moral value is infinite. Most of us agree that it is ethically permissible to divert a runaway trolley that threatens to kill five people onto a sidetrack where it would kill only one. But suppose it were 100 million lives one could save by diverting the trolley, or 1 billion, or, projecting into the indefinite future, infinitely many. How many people would it be permissible to sacrifice to attain that infinite good? A few million can seem like a pretty good bargain. Not only that, but consider the people who learn about the promise of a perfect world, yet nonetheless oppose it. They are the only things standing in the way of a plan that could lead to infinite goodness. How evil are they? You do the math. The second genocidal hazard of a utopia is that it has to conform to a tidy blueprint. In a utopia, everything is there for a reason. What about the people? Well, groups of people are diverse. Some of them stubbornly, perhaps essentially, cling to values that are out of place in a perfect world. They may be entrepreneurial in a world that works by communal sharing, or bookish in a world that works by labor, or brash in a world that works by piety, or clannish in a world that works by unity, or urban and commercial in a world that has returned to its roots in nature. If you are designing the perfect society on a clean sheet of paper, why not write these eyesores out of the plans from the start? In Blood and Soil, A World History of Genocide and Extermination from Sparta to Darfur, the historian Ben Kiernan notes another curious feature of utopian ideologies. Time and again they hark back to a vanished agrarian paradise, which they seek to restore as a healthful substitute for prevailing urban decadence. In Chapter 4, we saw that after the Enlightenment had emerged from the intellectual bazaar of cosmopolitan cities, the German counter-Enlightenment romanticized the attachment of a people to their land, the blood and soil of Kiernan's title. The ungovernable metropolis, with its fluid population and ethnic and occupational enclaves, is an affront to a mindset that envisions a world of harmony, purity, and organic wholeness. Many of the nationalisms of the 19th and early 20th centuries were guided by utopian images of ethnic groups flourishing in their native homelands, often based on myths of ancestral tribes who settled the territory at the dawn of time. This agrarian utopianism lay behind Hitler's dual obsessions, his loathing of Jewry, which he associated with commerce and cities, and his deranged plan to depopulate Eastern Europe to provide farmland for German city dwellers to colonize. Mao's massive agrarian communes and Pol Pot's expulsion of Cambodian city dwellers to rural killing fields are other examples. Commercial activities, which tend to be concentrated in cities, can themselves be triggers of moralistic hatred. As we shall see in Chapter 9, people's intuitive sense of economics is rooted in tit-for-tat exchanges of concrete goods or services of equivalent value, say, 3 chickens for 1 knife. It does not easily grasp the abstract mathematical apparatus of a modern economy, such as money, profit, interest, and rent. In intuitive economics, farmers and craftsmen produce palpable items of value. Merchants and other middlemen who skim off a profit as they pass goods along without causing new stuff to come into being are seen as parasites, despite the value they create by enabling transactions between producers and consumers who are unacquainted or separated by distance. Money lenders who loan out a sum and then demand additional money in return are held in even greater contempt, despite the service they render by providing people with money at times in their lives when it can be put to the best use. People tend to be oblivious to the intangible contributions of merchants and moneylenders and view them as bloodsuckers. Once again, the metaphor comes from biology. Antipathy toward individual middlemen can easily transfer to antipathy to ethnic groups. The capital necessary to prosper in middlemen occupations consists mainly of expertise rather than land or factories, so it is easily shared among kin and friends, and it is highly portable. For these reasons, it's common for particular ethnic groups to specialize in the middleman niche and to move to whatever communities currently lack them, where they tend to become prosperous minorities and targets of envy and resentment. Many victims of discrimination, expulsion, riots, and genocide have been social or ethnic groups that specialize in middlemen niches. They include various bourgeois minorities in the Soviet Union, China, and Cambodia, the Indians in East Africa and Oceania, the Igbos in Nigeria, the Armenians in Turkey, the Chinese in Indonesia, Malaysia, and Vietnam, and the Jews in Europe. Democides are often scripted into the climax of an eschatological narrative, a final spasm of violence that will usher in millennial bliss. The parallels between the utopian ideologies of the 19th and 20th centuries and the apocalyptic visions of traditional religions have often been noticed by historians of genocide. Daniel Shiroe, writing with the social psychiatrist Clark McCauley, observes, "Marxist eschatology actually mimicked Christian doctrine. In the beginning, there was a perfect world with no private property, no classes, no exploitation, and no alienation. The Garden of Eden. Then came sin, the discovery of private property and the creation of exploiters. Humanity was cast from the garden to suffer inequality and want. Humans then experimented with a series of modes of production, from the slave to the feudal to the capitalist mode, always seeking the solution and not finding it. Finally, there came a true prophet with a message of salvation, Karl Marx, who preached the truth of science. He promised redemption but was not heeded, except by his close disciples who carried the truth forward. Eventually, however, the proletariat, the carriers of the true faith, will be converted by the religious elect, the leaders of the party, and joined to create a more perfect world. A final terrible revolution will wipe out capitalism, alienation, exploitation, and inequality. After that, history will end, because there will be perfection on earth, and the true believers will have been saved." Drawing on the work of the historians Joachim Fest and George Moss, they also comment on Nazi eschatology. It was not an accident that Hitler promised a thousand-year Reich, a millennium of perfection similar to the thousand-year reign of goodness promised in Revelation before the return of evil, the great battle between good and evil, and the final triumph of God over Satan. The entire imagery of his Nazi party and regime was deeply mystical, suffused with religious, often Christian, liturgical symbolism, and it appealed to a higher law, to a mission decreed by fate and entrusted to the prophet Hitler. Finally, there are the job requirements. Would you want the stress and responsibility of running a perfect world? Utopian leadership selects for monumental narcissism and ruthlessness. Its leaders are possessed of a certainty about the rectitude of their cause and an impatience for incremental reforms or on-the-fly adjustments guided by feedback from the human consequences of their grand schemes. Mao, who had his image plastered all over China and his little red book of sayings issued to every citizen, was described by his doctor and only confidant, Li Jisui, as voracious for flattery, demanding of sexual servicing by concubines, and devoid of warmth and compassion. In 1958, he had a revelation that the country could double its steel production in a year if peasant families contributed to the national output by running backyard smelters. On pain of death for failing to meet the quotas, peasants melted down their woks, knives, shovels, and doorknobs into lumps of useless metal. It was also revealed to him that China could grow large quantities of grain on small plots of land, freeing the rest for grasslands and gardens, if farmers planted the seedlings deep and close together, so that class solidarity would make them grow strong and thick. Peasants were herded into communes of 50,000 to implement this vision, and anyone who dragged his feet or pointed out the obvious was executed as a class enemy. Impervious to signals from reality informing him that his great leap forward was a great leap backward, Mao masterminded a famine that killed between 20 million and 30 million people. The motives of leaders are critical in understanding genocide because the psychological ingredients, the mindset of essentialism, the Hobbesian dynamic of greed, fear, and vengeance, the moralization of emotions like disgust, and the appeal of utopian ideologies do not overcome an entire population at once and incite them to mass killing. Groups that avoid, distrust, or even despise each other can coexist without genocide indefinitely. Think, for example, of African Americans in the segregated American South, Palestinians in Israel and the occupied territories, and Africans in South Africa under apartheid. Even in Nazi Germany, where anti-Semitism had been entrenched for centuries, there is no indication that anyone but Hitler and a few fanatical henchmen thought it was a good idea for the Jews to be exterminated. When a genocide is carried out, only a fraction of the population, usually a police force, military unit, or militia, actually commits the murders. In the first century CE, Tacitus wrote, "A shocking crime was committed on the unscrupulous initiative of a few individuals with the blessing of more and amid the passive acquiescence of all." According to the political scientist Benjamin Valentino in Final Solutions, that division of labor applies to the genocides of the 20th century as well. A leader or small clique decides that the time for genocide is right. He gives the go-ahead to a relatively small force of armed men, made up of a mixture of true believers, conformists, and thugs, often recruited, as in medieval armies, from the ranks of criminals, drifters, and other unemployable young men. They count on the rest of the population not to get in their way, and thanks to features of social psychology that we will explore in Chapter 8, they generally don't. The psychological contributors to genocide, such as essentialism, moralization, and utopian ideologies, are engaged to different degrees in each of these constituencies. They consume the minds of the leaders and the true believers, but have to tip the others only enough to allow the leaders to make their plans a reality. The indispensability of leaders to 20th century genocide is made plain by the fact that when the leaders died or were removed by force, the killings stopped. If this analysis is on the right track, genocides can emerge from toxic reactions among human nature, including essentialism, moralization, and intuitive economics. Hobbesian security dilemmas, millennial ideologies, and the opportunities available to leaders. The question now is, how has this interaction changed over the course of history? It's not an easy question to answer, because historians have never found genocide particularly interesting. Since antiquity, the stacks of libraries have been filled with scholarship on war, but scholarship on genocide is nearly non-existent, though it killed more people. As Chalk and Jonasson pointed out of ancient histories, we know that empires have disappeared and that cities were destroyed, and we suspect that some wars were genocidal in their results, but we do not know what happened to the bulk of the populations involved in these events. Their fate was simply too unimportant. When they were mentioned at all, they were usually lumped together with the herds of oxen, sheep, and other livestock. As soon as one realizes that the sackings, raising, and massacres of past centuries are what we would call genocide today, it becomes utterly clear that genocide is not a phenomenon of the 20th century. Those familiar with classical history know that the Athenians destroyed Milos during the 5th century BCE Peloponnesian War. According to Thucydides, the Athenians thereupon put to death all who were of military age and made slaves of the women and children. Another familiar example is the Romans' destruction of Carthage and its population during the 3rd Punic War in the 3rd century BCE, a war so total that the Romans, it was said, sowed salt into the ground to make it forever unfarmable. Other historical genocides include the real-life bloodbaths that inspired the ones narrated in the Iliad, the Odyssey, and the Hebrew Bible, the massacres and sackings during the Crusades, the suppression of the Albigensian heresy, the Mongol invasions, the European witch hunts, and the carnage of the European wars of religion. The authors of recent histories of mass killing are adamant that the idea of an unprecedented century of genocide, the 20th, is a myth. On their first page, Chalk and Jonasson write, "Genocide has been practiced in all regions of the world and during all periods in history," and add that their 11 case studies of pre-20th century genocides are not intended to be either exhaustive or representative. Kiernan agrees. A major conclusion of this book is that genocide indeed occurred commonly before the 20th century. One can see what he means with a glance at the first page of his table of contents. Part 1. Early Imperial Expansion. 1. Classical Genocide and Early Modern Memory. 2. The Spanish Conquest of the New World, 1492 through 1600. 3. Guns and Genocide in East Asia, 1400 through 1600. 4. Genocidal Massacres in Early Modern Southeast Asia. Part 2. Settler Colonialism. 5. The English Conquest of Ireland, 1565 to 1603. 6. Colonial North America, 1600 through 1776. 7. Genocidal Violence in 19th Century Australia. 8. Genocide in the United States. 9. Settler Genocides in Africa, 1830 through 1910. Rummel has fitted a number to his own conclusion that the mass murder by emperors, kings, sultans, khans, presidents, governors, generals, and other rulers of their own citizens, or of those under their protection or control, is very much part of our history. He counts 133,147,000 victims of 16 democides before the 20th century, including ones in India, Iran, the Ottoman Empire, Japan, and Russia, and surmises that there may have been 625,716,000 democide victims in all. These authors did not compile their lists by indiscriminately piling up every historical episode in which a lot of people died. They are careful to note, for example, that the Native American population was decimated by disease rather than by a program of extermination, while particular incidents were blatantly genocidal. In an early example, Puritans in New England exterminated the Pequot Nation in 1638, after which the minister Increase Mather asked his congregation to thank God that on this day we have sent 600 heathen souls to hell. This celebration of genocide did not hurt his career. He later became president of Harvard University, and the residential house with which I am currently affiliated is named after him. Motto: Increase Mather's Spirit. Mather was neither the first nor the last to thank God for genocide. As we saw in Chapter 1, Yahweh ordered the Hebrew tribes to carry out dozens of them, and in the 9th century BCE, the Moabites returned the favor by massacring the inhabitants of several Hebrew cities in the name of their god, Ashtar Chemosh. In a passage from the Bhagavad Gita, written around 400 CE, the Hindu god Krishna upbraids the mortal Arjuna for being reluctant to slay an enemy faction that included his grandfather and tutor. There is no better engagement for you than fighting on religious principles, and so there is no need for hesitation. The soul can never be cut to pieces by any weapon, nor burned by fire. Therefore, you are mourning for what is not worthy of grief. Inspired by the conquests of Joshua, Oliver Cromwell massacred every man, woman, and child in an Irish town during the reconquest of Ireland and explained his actions to Parliament. It has pleased God to bless our endeavor at Drogheda. The enemy were about 3,000 strong in the town. I believe we put to the sword the whole number. The English Parliament passed a unanimous motion that the House does approve of the execution done at Drogheda as an act of both justice to them and mercy to others who may be warned of it. The shocking truth is that until recently, most people didn't think there was anything particularly wrong with genocide, as long as it didn't happen to them. One exception was the 16th century Spanish priest Antonio de Montesinos, who protested the appalling treatment of Native Americans by the Spanish in the Caribbean, and who was, in his own words, a voice of one crying in the wilderness. There were, to be sure, military codes of honor, some from the Middle Ages, that ineffectually attempted to outlaw the killing of civilians in war, and occasional protests by thinkers of early modernity, such as Erasmus and Hugo Grotius. But only in the late 19th century, when citizens began to protest the brutalization of peoples in the American West and the British Empire, did objections to genocide become common. Even then, we find Theodore Roosevelt, the future progressive president and Nobel Peace Laureate, writing in 1886, "I don't go so far as to think that the only good Indians are the dead Indians, but I believe 9 out of 10 are, and I shouldn't like to inquire too closely in the case of the 10th. The critic John Carey documents that well into the 20th century, the British literary intelligentsia viciously dehumanized the teeming masses, whom they considered to be so vulgar and soulless as not to have lives worth living. Genocidal fantasies were not uncommon. In 1908, for example, D.H. Lawrence wrote, "If I had my way, I would build a lethal chamber as big as the Crystal Palace with a military band playing softly and a cinematograph working brightly. Then I'd go out in the back streets and main streets and bring them in, all the sick, the halt, and the maimed. I would lead them gently, and they would smile me a weary thanks, and the band would softly bubble out the Hallelujah Chorus." During World War II, when Americans were asked in opinion polls what should be done with the Japanese after an American victory, 10 to 15% volunteered the solution of extermination. The turning point came after the war. The English language did not even have a word for genocide until 1944, when the Polish lawyer Raphael Lemkin coined it in a report on the Nazi rule in Europe that would be used a year later to brief the prosecutors at the Nuremberg trials. In the aftermath of the Nazi destruction of European Jewry, the world was stunned by the enormity of the death toll and by horrific images from the liberated camps, assembly line gas chambers and crematoria, mountains of shoes and eyeglasses, bodies stacked up like cordwood. In 1948, Lemkin got the UN to approve a convention on the prevention and punishment of the crime of genocide. And for the first time in history, genocide, regardless of who the victims were, was a crime. James Payne notes a perverse sign of progress. Today's Holocaust deniers at least feel compelled to deny that the Holocaust took place. In earlier centuries, the perpetrators of genocide and their sympathizers boasted about it. No small part in the new awareness of the horrors of genocide was a willingness of Holocaust survivors to tell their stories. Chalk and Jonasson note that these memoirs are historically unusual. Survivors of earlier genocides had treated them as humiliating defeats and felt that talking about them would only rub in history's harsh verdict. With the new humanitarian sensibilities, genocides became crimes against humanity, and survivors were witnesses for the prosecution. Anne Frank's diary, which recorded her life in hiding in Nazi-occupied Amsterdam before she was deported to her death in Bergen-Belsen, was published by her father shortly after the war. Memoirs of deportations and death camps by Elie Wiesel and Primo Levi were published in the 1960s, and today Frank's diary and Wiesel's Night are among the world's most widely read books. In the years that followed, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, An Chi Minh, and Dith Pran shared their harrowing memories of the communist nightmares in the Soviet Union, China, and Cambodia. Soon other survivors, Armenians, Ukrainians, Gypsies, began to add their stories, joined more recently by Bosnians, Tutsis, and Darfuris. These memoirs are a part of a reorientation of our conception of history. Throughout most of history, Chalk and Jonasson note, only the rulers made news. In the 20th century, for the first time, it is the ruled who make the news. Anyone who grew up with Holocaust survivors knows what they had to overcome to tell their stories. For decades after the war, they treated their experiences as shameful secrets. On top of the ignominy of victimhood, the desperate straits to which they were reduced could remove the last traces of their humanity in ways they could be forgiven for wanting to forget. At a family occasion in the 1990s, I met a relative by marriage who had spent time in Auschwitz. Within seconds of meeting me, he clenched my wrist and recounted this story. A group of men had been eating in silence when one of them slumped over dead. The others fell on his body, still covered in diarrhea, and pried a piece of bread from his fingers. As they divided it, a fierce argument broke out when some of the men felt their share was an imperceptible crumb, smaller than the others. To tell a story of such degradation requires extraordinary courage, backed by a confidence that the hearer will understand it as an accounting of the circumstances and not of the men's characters. Though the abundance of genocides over the millennia belies the century of genocide claim, one still wonders about the trajectory of genocide before, during, and since the 20th century. Rummel was the first political scientist to try to put some numbers together. In his duology, Death by Government, 1994, and Statistics of Democide, 1997, he analyzed 141 regimes that committed democides in the 20th century through 1987, and a control group of 73 that did not. He collected as many independent estimates of the death tolls as he could find, including ones from pro- and anti-government sources, whose biases he assumed would cancel each other out, and, with the help of sanity checks, chose a defensible value near the middle of the range. His definition of democide corresponds roughly to the UCDP's one-sided violence and to our everyday concept of murder. But with a government rather than an individual as the perpetrator, the victims must be unarmed and the killing deliberate. Democides thus include ethnocides, politicides, purges, terrors, killings of civilians by death squads, including ones committed by private militias to which the government turns a blind eye, deliberate famines from blockades and confiscation of food, deaths in internment camps, and the targeted bombing of civilians such as those in Dresden, Hamburg, Hiroshima, and Nagasaki. Rummel excluded the Great Leap Forward from his 1994 analyses on the understanding that it was caused by stupidity and callousness rather than malice. Partly because the phrase death by government figured in Rummel's definition of democide and in the title of his book, His conclusion that almost 170 million people were killed by their governments during the 20th century has become a popular meme among anarchists and radical libertarians. But for several reasons, governments are the main cause of preventable deaths is not the correct lesson to draw from Rummel's data. For one thing, his definition of government is loose, embracing militias, paramilitaries, and warlords, all of which could reasonably be seen as a sign of too little government rather than too much. White examined Rummel's raw data and calculated that the median democide toll by the 24 pseudo-governments on his list was around 100,000, whereas the median death toll caused by recognized governments of sovereign states was 33,000. So one could, with more justification, conclude that governments, on average, cause 3 times fewer deaths than alternatives to government. Also, most governments in recent periods do not commit democides at all, and they prevent a far greater number of deaths than the democidal ones cause by promoting vaccination, sanitation, traffic safety, and policing. But the main problem with the anarchist interpretation is that it isn't governments in general that kill large numbers of people, but a handful of governments of a specific type. To be exact, 3/4 of all the deaths from all 141 democidal regimes were committed by just 4 governments, which Rummel calls the Decamega murderers: the Soviet Union with 62 million, the People's Republic of China with 35 million, Nazi Germany with 21 million, and 1928 through 49 Nationalist China with 10 million. Another 11% of the total were killed by 11 mega-murderers, including Imperial Japan with 6 million, Cambodia with 2 million, and Ottoman Turkey with 1.9 million. The remaining 13% of the deaths were spread out over 126 regimes. Genocides don't exactly fall into a power law distribution, if for no other reason than that the smaller massacres tend not to be counted as genocides. But the distribution is enormously lopsided, conforming to an 80-4 rule. 80% of the deaths were caused by 4% of the regimes. Also, deaths from democide were overwhelmingly caused by totalitarian governments, the communist, Nazi, fascist, militarist, or Islamist regimes that sought to control every aspect of the societies they ruled. Totalitarian regimes were responsible for 138 million deaths, 82% of the total, of which 110 million, 65% of the total, were caused by communist regimes. Authoritarian regimes, which are autocracies that tolerate independent social institutions such as businesses and churches, came in second with 28 million deaths. Democracies, which Rummel defines as governments that are open, competitive, elected, and limited in their power, killed 2 million, mainly in their colonial empires, together with food blockades and civilian bombings during the world wars. The skew of distribution does not just reflect the sheer number of potential victims that totalitarian behemoths like the Soviet Union and China had at their disposal. When Rummel looked at percentages rather than numbers, he found that totalitarian governments of the 20th century racked up a death toll adding up to 4% of their populations. Authoritarian governments killed 1%. Democracies killed 0.4%. Rummel was one of the first advocates of the democratic peace theory, which he argues applied to democides even more than to wars. At the extremes of power, Rummel writes, totalitarian communist governments slaughter their people by the tens of millions. In contrast, many democracies can barely bring themselves to execute even serial murderers. Democracies commit fewer democides because their form of governance, by definition, is committed to inclusive and nonviolent means of resolving conflicts. More important, the power of a democratic government is restricted by a tangle of institutional restraints. So a leader can't just mobilize armies and militias on a whim to fan out over the country and start killing massive numbers of citizens. By performing a set of regressions on his data set of 20th century regimes, Rummel showed that the occurrence of democide correlates with a lack of democracy, even holding constant the country's ethnic diversity, wealth, level of development, population density, and culture, African, Asian, Latin American, Muslim, Anglo, and so on. The lessons he writes are clear. The problem is power. The solution is democracy. The course of action is to foster freedom. What about the historical trajectory? Rummel tried to break down his 20th century democides by year. Like deaths in wars, deaths in democides were concentrated in a savage burst, the mid-century hemoclism. This blood flow embraced the Nazi Holocaust, Stalin's purges, the Japanese rape of China and Korea, and the wartime firebombings of cities in Europe and Japan. Democides before the mid-century include the Armenian genocide during World War I and the Soviet collectivization campaign, which killed millions of Ukrainians and kulaks, the so-called rich peasants. The post-World War II period embraces the killing of millions of ethnic Germans in newly communized Poland, Czechoslovakia, and Romania, and the victims of forced collectivization in China. It's uncomfortable to say that there's anything good in the trends, but in an important sense, there is. The world has seen nothing close to the bloodletting of the 1940s. Since then, in the four decades that followed, the rate and number of deaths from democide went precipitously, if lurchingly, downward. Smaller increases represent killings by Pakistani forces during the Bangladesh War of Independence in 1971 and by the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia in the late 1970s. Rummel attributes the fall-off in democide since World War II to the decline of totalitarianism and the rise of democracy. Rummel's dataset ends in 1987, just when things started to get interesting again. Soon communism fell and democracies proliferated, and the world was hit with the unpleasant surprise of genocides in Bosnia and Rwanda. In the impression of many observers, these new wars show that we are still living, despite all we should have learned, in an age of genocide. The historical thread of genocide statistics has recently been extended by the political scientist Barbara Harf. During the Rwanda genocide, some 700,000 Tutsis were killed in just 4 months by about 10,000 men with machetes, many of them drunkards, addicts, rag pickers, and gang members hastily recruited by the Hutu leadership. Many observers believe that this small pack of genocidaires could easily have been stopped by a military intervention by the world's great powers. Bill Clinton, in particular, was haunted by his own failure to act, and in 1998, he commissioned Harf to analyze the risk factors and warning signs of genocide. She assembled a dataset of 41 genocides and politicides between 1955, shortly after Stalin died, and the process of decolonization began, and 2004. Her criteria were more restrictive than Rummel's and closer to Lemkin's original definition of genocide, episodes of violence in which a state or armed authority intends to destroy, in whole or in part, an identifiable group. Only 5 of the episodes turned out to be genocide in the sense in which people ordinarily understand the term, namely an ethnocide, in which a group is singled out for destruction because of its ethnicity. Most were politicides or politicides combined with ethnocides, in which members of an ethnic group were thought to be aligned with a targeted political faction. Harf's numbers generally come in well below Rummel's, especially in the late 1950s, for which she included far fewer victims of the executions during the Great Leap Forward. But thereafter, the numbers show similar trends, which are downward from their peak in 1971. The genocides from the second half of the 20th century were much less destructive than those of the hemoclism. The two decades since the Cold War have not seen a recrudescence of genocide. On the contrary, the peak in mass killing, putting aside China in the 1950s, is located in the mid-1960s to late 1970s. Those 15 years saw a politicide against communists in Indonesia, 1965, through 66, the year of living dangerously, with 700,000 deaths, the Chinese Cultural Revolution, 1966 through 75, around 600,000, Tutsis against Hutus in Burundi, 1965 through 73, 140,000, Pakistan's massacre in Bangladesh, 1971, around 1.7 million. North against South violence in Sudan, 1956 through 72, around 500,000. Idi Amin's regime in Uganda, 1972 through 79, around 150,000. The Cambodian madness, 1975 through 79, 2.5 million, and a decade of massacres in Vietnam culminating in the expulsion of the Boat People, 1965 through 75, around 500,000. The two decades since the end of the Cold War have been marked by genocides in Bosnia from 1992 to 1995, 225,000 deaths, Rwanda, 700,000 deaths, and Darfur, 373,000 deaths from 2003 to 2008. These are atrocious numbers. But they are spikes in a trend that is unmistakably downward. Recent studies have shown that even some of these figures may be overestimates, but I will stick with the data sets. The first decade of the new millennium is the most genocide-free of the past 50 years. The UCDP numbers are restricted to a narrower time window, and, like all their estimates, are more conservative. But they show a similar pattern. The Rwanda genocide in 1994 leaps out from all the other episodes of one-sided killing, and the world has seen nothing like it since. Harf was tasked not just with compiling genocides, but with identifying their risk factors. She noted that virtually all of them took place in the aftermath of a state failure, such as a civil war, revolution, or coup. So she assembled a control group with 93 cases of state failure that did not result in genocide, matched as closely as possible to the ones that did, and ran a logistic regression analysis to find out which aspects of the situation the year before made the difference. Some factors that one might think were important turned out not to be. Measures of ethnic diversity didn't matter, refuting the conventional wisdom that genocides represent the eruption of ancient hatreds that inevitably explode when ethnic groups live side by side. Nor did measures of economic development matter. Poor countries are more likely to have political crises, which are necessary conditions for genocides to take place. But among the countries that did have crises, the poorer ones were no more likely to sink into actual genocide. Harf did discover six risk factors that distinguish the genocidal from the non-genocidal crises in three-quarters of the cases. One was a country's previous history of genocide, presumably because whatever risk factors were in place the first time did not vanish overnight. The second predictor was the country's immediate history of political instability. To be exact, the number of regime crises and ethnic or revolutionary wars it had suffered in the preceding 15 years. Governments that feel threatened are tempted to eliminate or take revenge on groups they perceive to be subversive or contaminating, and are more likely to exploit the ongoing chaos to accomplish those goals before opposition can mobilize. A third was a ruling elite that came from an ethnic minority, presumably because that multiplies the leaders' worries about the precariousness of their rule. The other three predictors are familiar from the theory of the liberal peace. Harf vindicated Rummel's insistence that democracy is a key factor in preventing genocides. From 1955 to 2008, autocracies were 3.5 times more likely to commit genocides than were full or partial democracies, holding everything else constant. This represents a hat trick for democracy. Democracies are less likely to wage interstate wars, to have large-scale civil wars, and to commit genocides. Partial democracies, anocracies, are more likely than autocracies to have violent political crises, as we saw in Fearon and Layton's analysis of civil wars. But when a crisis does occur, the partial democracies are less likely than autocracies to become genocidal. Another trifecta was scored by openness to trade. Countries that depend more on international trade, Harf found, are less likely to commit genocides, just as they are less likely to fight wars with other countries and to be riven by civil wars. The inoculating effects of trade against genocide cannot depend, as they do in the case of interstate war, on the positive-sum benefits of trade itself, since the trade we are talking about, imports and exports, does not consist in exchanges with the vulnerable ethnic or political groups. Why then should trade matter? One possibility is that country A might take a communal or moral interest in a group living within the borders of country B. If B wants to trade with A, it must resist the temptation to exterminate that group. Another is that a desire to engage in trade requires certain peaceable attitudes, including a willingness to abide by international norms and the rule of law, and a mission to enhance the material welfare of its citizens, rather than implementing a vision of purity, glory, or perfect justice. The last predictor of genocide is an exclusionary ideology. Ruling elites that are under the spell of a vision that identifies a certain group as the obstacle to an ideal society, putting it outside the sanctioned universe of obligation, are far more likely to commit genocide than elites with a more pragmatic or eclectic governing philosophy. Exclusionary ideologies, in Harf's classification, include Marxism, Islamism, in particular a strict application of Sharia law, militaristic anti-communism, and forms of nationalism that demonize ethnic or religious rivals. Harf sums up the pathways by which these risk factors erupt into genocide. Almost all genocides and politicides of the last half century were either ideological, exemplified by the Cambodian case, or retributive, as in Iraq, Saddam Hussein's 1988-91 campaign against Iraqi Kurds. The scenario that leads to ideological genocide begins when a new elite comes to power, usually through civil war or revolution, with a transforming vision of a new society purified of unwanted or threatening elements. Retributive genopoliticides occur during a protracted internal war, when one party, usually the government, seeks to destroy its opponent's support base, or after a rebel challenge has been militarily defeated. The decline of genocide over the last third of a century, then, may be traced to the upswing of some of the same factors that drove down interstate and civil wars: stable government, democracy, openness to trade, and humanistic ruling philosophies that elevate the interests of individuals over struggles among groups. For all the rigor that a logistic regression offers, it is essentially a meat grinder that takes a set of variables as input and extrudes a probability as output. What it hides is the vastly skewed distribution of the human costs of different genocides, the way that a small number of men, under the sway of a smaller number of ideologies, took actions at particular moments in history that caused outsized number of deaths. Shifts in the levels of the risk factors certainly pushed around the likelihood of the genocides that racked up thousands, tens of thousands, and even hundreds of thousands of deaths. But the truly monstrous genocides, the ones with tens of millions of victims, depended not so much on gradually shifting political forces as on a few contingent ideas and events. The appearance of Marxist ideology in particular was a historical tsunami that is breathtaking in its total human impact. It led to the Decamega murders by Marxist regimes in the Soviet Union and China, and more circuitously, it contributed to the one committed by the Nazi regime in Germany. Hitler read Marx in 1913, and although he detested Marxist socialism, his National Socialism substituted races for classes in its ideology of a dialectical struggle toward utopia, which is why some historians consider the two ideologies fraternal twins. Marxism also set off reactions that led to politicides by militantly anti-communist regimes in Indonesia and Latin America, and to the destructive civil wars of the 1960s, 1970s, and 1980s, stoked by the Cold War superpowers. The point is not that Marxism should be morally blamed for these unintended consequences, just that any historical narrative must acknowledge the sweeping repercussions of this single idea. Valentino notes that no small part of the decline of genocide is the decline of communism, and thus The single most important cause of mass killing in the 20th century appears to be fading into history. Nor is it likely that it will come back into fashion. During its heyday, violence by Marxist regimes was justified with the saying, "You can't make an omelet without breaking eggs." The historian Richard Pipes summarized history's verdict, "Aside from the fact that human beings are not eggs, the trouble is that no omelet has emerged from the slaughter." Valentino concludes that it may be premature to celebrate the end of history. But if no similarly radical ideas gain the widespread applicability and acceptance of communism, humanity may be able to look forward to considerably less mass killing in the coming century than it experienced in the last. On top of that singularly destructive ideology were the catastrophic decisions of a few men who took the stage at particular moments in the 20th century. I've already mentioned that many historians have joined the chorus, "No Hitler, no Holocaust." But Hitler was not the only tyrant whose obsessions killed tens of millions. The historian Robert Conquest, an authority on Stalin's politicides, concluded that the nature of the whole purge depends in the last analysis on the personal and political drives of Stalin. As for China, it is inconceivable that the record-setting famine of the Great Leap Forward would have occurred but for Mao's harebrained schemes, and the historian Harry Harding noted of the country's subsequent politicide that the principal responsibility for the Cultural Revolution, a movement that affected tens of millions of Chinese, rests with one man. Without a Mao, there could not have been a Cultural Revolution. With such a small number of data points causing such a large share of the devastation, we will never really know how to explain the most calamitous events of the 20th century. The ideologies prepared the ground and attracted the men. The absence of democracy gave them the opportunity. But tens of millions of deaths ultimately depended on the decisions of just three individuals. The trajectory of terrorism. Terrorism is a peculiar category of violence because it has a cockeyed ratio of fear to harm. Compared to the number of deaths from homicide, war, and genocide, the worldwide toll from terrorism is in the noise, fewer than 400 deaths a year since 1968 from international terrorism, where perpetrators from one country cause damage in another, and about 2,500 a year since 1998 from domestic terrorism. The numbers we have been dealing with in this chapter have been at least two orders of magnitude higher. But after the September 11, 2001 attacks, terrorism became an obsession. Pundits and politicians turned up the rhetoric to 11, and the word existential, generally modifying threat or crisis, had not seen as much use since the heyday of Sartre and Camus. Experts proclaimed that terrorism made the United States vulnerable and fragile, and that it threatened to do away with the ascendancy of the modern state, our way of life, or civilization itself. In a 2005 essay in The Atlantic, for example, a former White House counterterrorism official confidently prophesied that by the 10th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, the American economy would be shut down by chronic bombings of casinos, subways, and shopping malls, the regular downing of commercial airliners by shoulder-launched missiles, and acts of cataclysmic sabotage at chemical plants. The massive bureaucracy of the Department of Homeland Security was created overnight to reassure the nation with such security theater as color-coded terrorist alerts, advisories to stock up on plastic sheeting and duct tape, obsessive checking of identification cards, despite fakes being so plentiful that George W. Bush's own daughter was arrested for using one to order a margarita, the confiscation of nail clippers at airports, the girding of rural post offices with concrete barriers, and the designation of 80,000 locations as potential terrorist targets, including Wekiwachi Springs, a Florida tourist trap in which comely women, dressed as mermaids, swim around in large glass tanks. All this was in response to a threat that has killed a trifling number of Americans, The nearly 3,000 deaths from the 9/11 attacks were literally off the chart of the power law distribution into which terrorist attacks fall. According to the Global Terrorism Database of the National Consortium for the Study of Terrorism and Responses to Terrorism, the major publicly available dataset on terrorist attacks, between 1970 and 2007, only one other terrorist attack in the entire world has killed as many as 500 people. In the United States, Timothy McVeigh's bombing of a federal office building in Oklahoma City in 1995 killed 165. A shooting spree by two teenagers at Columbine High School in 1999 killed 17, and no other attack has killed as many as a dozen. Other than 9/11, the number of people killed by terrorists on American soil during these 38 years was 340, and the number killed after 9/11, the date that inaugurated the so-called Age of Terror, was 11. While some additional plots were foiled by the Department of Homeland Security, many of their claims have turned out to be the proverbial elephant repellent, with every elephant-free day serving as proof of its effectiveness. Compare the American death toll, with or without 9/11, to other preventable causes of death. Every year, more than 40,000 Americans are killed in traffic accidents, 20,000 in falls, 18,000 in homicides, 3,000 by drowning, including 300 in bathtubs, 3,000 in fires, 24,000 from accidental poisoning, 2,500 from complications of surgery, 300 from suffocation in bed, 300 from inhalation of gastric contents, and 17,000 by other and unspecified non-transport accidents and their sequela. In fact, in every year but 1995 and 2001, more Americans were killed by lightning, deer, peanut allergies, bee stings, and ignition or melting of nightwear than by terrorist attacks. The number of deaths from terrorist attacks is so small that even minor measures to avoid them can increase the risk of dying. The cognitive psychologist Gerd Geigerinzer has estimated that in the year after the 9/11 attacks, 1,500 Americans died in car accidents because they chose to drive rather than fly to their destinations out of fear of dying in a hijacked or sabotaged plane, unaware that the risk of death in a plane flight from Boston to Los Angeles is the same as the risk of death in a car trip of 12 miles. In other words, the number of people who died by avoiding air travel was 6 times the number of people who died in the airplanes on September 11th. And, of course, the 9/11 attacks sent the United States into 2 wars that have taken far more American and British lives than the hijackers did, to say nothing of the lives of Afghans and Iraqis. The discrepancy between the panic generated by terrorism and the deaths generated by terrorism is no accident. Panic is the whole point of terrorism, as the word itself makes clear. Though definitions vary, as in the cliché, one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter, terrorism is generally understood as premeditated violence perpetrated by a non-state actor against non-combatants, civilians or off-duty soldiers, in pursuit of a political, religious, or social goal, designed to coerce a government or to intimidate or convey a message to a larger audience. The terrorists may want to extort a government into capitulating to a demand, to sap people's confidence in their government's ability to protect them, or to provoke mass repression that will turn people against their government or bring about violent chaos in which the terrorist faction hopes to prevail. Terrorists are altruistic in the sense of being motivated by a cause rather than by personal profit. They act by surprise and in secrecy, hence the ubiquitous appellation cowardly, and they are communicators seeking publicity and attention, which they manufacture through fear. Terrorism is a form of asymmetrical warfare, a tactic of the weak against the strong, which leverages the psychology of fear to create emotional damage that is disproportionate to its damage in lives or property. Cognitive psychologists such as Tversky, Kahneman, Geigerinzer, and Slovak have shown that the perceived danger of a risk depends on two mental hobgoblins. The first is fathomability. It's better to deal with the devil you know than the devil you don't. People are nervous about risks that are novel, undetectable, delayed in their effects, and poorly understood by the science of the day. The second contributor is dread. People worry about worst-case scenarios.